Chapter 1. I Just Want to Clean Up the Mess. In 1977, a candidate for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors invited reporters to a press conference at a local park. He said he was going to announce legislation essential to improving the quality of life in the city. With a pack of cameras waiting for him, the man walked across the grass toward them before stopping, making a face, and lifting up his foot to look at the bottom of his shoe, only to discover, in feigned horror, that he had stepped in dog poop. After pretending to be surprised and flashing a big smile, the man turned toward the cameras and announced legislation he would introduce once elected that required San Franciscans to pick up their dog's poop. It was a savvy and ultimately successful move for the handsome 40-something-year-old candidate. The number one quality of life issue for San Franciscans had become the large amount of uncollected dog feces on sidewalks and in parks. The man had run for supervisor twice before, coming in 10th the first time and 7th the second time. But he never connected with a majority of voters. This time, having identified an issue that people cared about, he was elected to the Board of Supervisors. His name was Harvey Milk. Today, we remember Milk as perhaps the most significant gay rights leader of all time. He is the person who unlocked the secret to reducing prejudice against same-sex relationships by people disclosing to friends and family that they were gay. Sean Penn won an Oscar after immortalizing Milk's life in a 2008 film. But Milk owed his political career to dog poop. Shortly after taking office in 1978, Milk introduced the Scoop the Poop Act, which by the end of the summer the Board of Supervisors had passed. Afterward, a journalist said to Milk, "The police department says it may be hard to enforce this," to which Milk replied, beaming, "I think it will be easy based on peer pressure. It's going to be hard to write citations, but when a San Franciscan is walking down the street and sees someone breaking the law, you say, 'Hey,' with a smile, 'You broke the law.' And after a while, when enough people do that, the message will be clear. It will be an education process. I really hope not one single citation is ever issued. I don't want to put anybody in jail. I don't want to fine anyone. I just want to clean up the mess." People overwhelmingly complied. It's true that dog owners still sometimes fail to pick up after their dogs, but dog owner behavior has changed drastically, and for exactly the reason Milk predicted it would: peer pressure. Dog owners felt and feel a moral obligation to take responsibility for their pets. As such, Milk's campaign to remove poop from San Francisco's parks and sidewalks was a resounding success. At least, that is, when it came from dogs. In 2018, San Francisco's mayor, London Breed, held a walking tour with television cameras and newspaper reporters in tow. "I will say that there's more feces on the sidewalks than I've ever seen," said Breed. "Growing up here, that was something that wasn't the norm." "Than you've ever seen?" asked the reporter. "Than I've ever seen, for sure," she said. "And we're not just talking about from dogs. We're talking about from humans." Complaints about human waste on San Francisco's sidewalks and streets were rising. Calls about human feces increased from 10,692 to 20,933 between 2014 and 2018. In 2019, the city spent nearly $100 million on street cleaning, four times more than Chicago, which has 3.5 times as many people and an area that is 4.5 times larger. Between 2015 and 2018, San Francisco replaced more than 300 lampposts corroded by urine after one had collapsed and crushed a car. The underlying problem was homelessness. Between 2013 and 2016, complaints of homeless encampments to the city's 311 line rose from 2 per day to 63 per day. In 2018, A major medical association decided to host its annual convention, worth about $40 million for the local economy, elsewhere, after decades of holding events in San Francisco. The condition of the homeless in San Francisco is internationally recognized as inhumane. In 2018, the United Nations Special Rapporteur visited San Francisco and said, "There's a cruelty here that I don't think I've seen, and I've done outreach on every continent." Many of San Francisco's homeless live in densely populated, centrally located areas. The most infamous of these is the Tenderloin, a downtown neighborhood that borders government buildings including City Hall, a major shopping district with several large tourist hotels, and many of the city's concert venues and museums. Some argue that the homelessness situation in San Francisco isn't worse than other cities. "New York City has a worse per capita homelessness problem than San Francisco," wrote a New Yorker reporter in 2020. "California's proportion of homeless residents trails that of New York, Washington, D.C., and Hawaii. The difference is that San Francisco has a far higher number who are unsheltered, sleeping on the streets, or in tents rather than in homeless shelters." Many studies show that warmer climates and more expensive housing are major factors behind higher rates of homelessness, both sheltered and unsheltered, in San Francisco, Seattle, and Los Angeles. In much of California, one can sleep outside for most of the year without freezing. Half of the unsheltered homeless population in the United States is in California and Florida alone, even though the two states are home to just 19% of the population. High-tech companies like Salesforce, Twitter, and Stripe, progressives noted, had attracted thousands of employees who had driven up rents, resulting in tenant evictions. In 2016, representatives from San Francisco's business, philanthropic, and media communities committed to halve the city's chronic homeless population in 5 years. They created a media initiative called the SF Homeless Project and raised over $130 million in the first year, with $100 million raised by an organization called Tipping Point and another $30 million coming from Mark Benioff, the billionaire CEO and founder of Salesforce, the customer relations software giant. The San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, a nonprofit organization, led a campaign to fund housing and services with a special tax on San Francisco businesses that gross more than $50 million annually. At first, few believed the measure, put before voters in the form of Proposition C, could pass. CEOs of other high-revenue tech companies in San Francisco, including Patrick Collison of Stripe and Jack Dorsey of Twitter, opposed Prop C, as did Mayor Breed. And the Coalition on Homelessness didn't have the money to pay for large-scale advertising and other costs of a citywide campaign. But then Benioff donated millions of dollars to the campaign for Proposition C. "What I see is a crisis of inequality in San Francisco," he said. "We have 1,200 homeless families, each with two kids. We have 70 billionaires here in our city. That's incredible." Benioff criticized the high-tech companies opposing Prop C. "Square is worth $30 billion," he said. "Twitter is worth $20 billion. Stripe, $20 billion. These are immaterial amounts to us. $10 million doesn't mean anything. That's less than the private plane that Twitter founder and CEO Jack Dorsey is going to fly around on," Benioff added. "You're either for the homeless and for the kids and for the hospitals, or you're for yourself." Benioff gave a $30 million grant to Dr. Margot Kuschel at the University of California, San Francisco, to study homelessness. "We've always known that most homelessness is a result, pure and simple, of poverty," she said. "One of the biggest myths is that it is caused by mental health and substance use problems," Kuschel explained. "We know that most homelessness is driven by economic forces." A study by the real estate website Zillow and the University of New Hampshire found that when median rent exceeded 22% of median income, the number of homeless people in a city grew and rose especially rapidly at 32%. The median San Francisco renter pays 39% of his or her income in rent. Some Bay Area reporters agree. The convenient narrative about homeless people is that they're lazy, mentally ill, or drug addicts, wrote one San Francisco Chronicle columnist. But that's not true. Survey data collected by the city, many pointed out, shows that one quarter of homeless cited job loss as the primary cause of their homelessness. 18% cited substance abuse, 13% eviction, and 8% mental illness. While all big cities struggle with homelessness, the West Coast cities of the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, and Seattle struggle more. The change over the last 15 years has been dramatic. Between 2005 and 2020, the estimated number of homeless people in San Francisco increased from 5,404 to 8,124. The estimated number of unsheltered homeless rose from 2,655 to 5,180. The San Francisco Bay Area as a whole saw sheltered and unsheltered homeless increase by 32% between 2015 and 2020, with the share of unsheltered homeless rising from 65% to 73%. The San Francisco Bay Area includes the counties of Alameda, Contra Costa, Marin, Napa, San Mateo, Santa Clara, Solano, Sonoma, and San Francisco. Total homelessness more than doubled in Alameda County, which includes Oakland and Berkeley, between 2015 and 2020. Meanwhile, homelessness declined in the nation as a whole, and in other big cities over the last decade and a half. Homelessness nationwide declined from 763,000 to 568,000 between 2005 and 2020. In the same 15-year period, the homeless populations of Chicago, Greater Miami, and Greater Atlanta declined 19%, 32%, and 43%, respectively. While it is true that New York City saw an increase of 62% in its homeless population between 2005 and 2020, over 99% of New York's homeless have access to shelter. In San Francisco, just 43% do. Against Benioff's suggestion that San Francisco's homeless population is heavily comprised of families with children, the research finds that far more homeless in the San Francisco Bay Area are adults without families than in other parts of the United States. Whereas families make up 32, 53, and 65% of the homeless in New York, Chicago, and Boston, they make up just 9% of the Bay Area's homeless population. San Francisco has a much higher share of unsheltered homeless who are chronically homeless than other cities. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, defines chronically homeless as those who have been homeless for a year, had 4 episodes of homelessness totaling 12 months in the last 3 years, or those who are too disabled to work. Of the roughly 5,200 unsheltered homeless people in San Francisco, 37% in 2020 were chronically homeless, in comparison to the 34%, 19%, 17%, and 16% chronically homeless in New York, Greater Phoenix, Greater San Diego, and Boston, respectively. San Francisco's mild climate alone cannot explain why it has more homeless people than other cities. Miami, Phoenix, and Houston have year-round warm weather and far fewer homeless than San Francisco per capita. Per capita homelessness in San Francisco, Greater Miami, Greater Phoenix, and Greater Houston in 2020 was 9.3, 1.3, 1.6, and 0.8 per 1,000 residents, respectively. And Greater Miami, Greater Phoenix, and Greater Houston saw their per capita homeless population decline from 2005 to 2020 by 39, 17, and 74%, while San Francisco saw its rise 30%. Nor can housing prices explain the discrepancy. Palo Alto and Beverly Hills have mild climates and expensive housing, but don't have San Francisco's homeless problem. As for the Zillow study that was reported to find a correlation between rising rents and homelessness, a deeper look at the research reveals a more nuanced finding. Homelessness and affordability are correlated only in the context of certain local policy efforts and social attitudes, concluded researchers. Other cities, including Chicago, Houston, and the greater Miami area, saw typical rents increase 24%, 32%, and 35%, and the number of homeless decline 20%, 57%, and 9% between 2011 and 2019, which are the years covered by the Zillow study, 2011 to 2017, plus 2018 and 2019. In Nashville, the number of chronically homeless fell 54% in the same period. While the homeless are poor, few poor people live on the street. Nearly 90,000 people in San Francisco live in poverty, but just over 8,000 are homeless. The vast majority of people, including very poor people who are priced out of San Francisco's expensive rental markets, move out of the city or move in with friends or family. Vanishingly few decide to pitch a tent on the filthiest sidewalks in America. Over the last decades, there were many visible signs that homelessness was about much more than poverty and housing. Between 2010 and 2020, the number of calls made to San Francisco's 311 line complaining of used hypodermic needles on sidewalks, in parks, and elsewhere rose from 224 to 6,275. In 2018, footage of dozens of people slumped over in an entrance to a Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART, station, many with needles in their arm, went viral. "We call it the heroin freeze," said one local. "They can stay that way for hours," said another. "It's like the land of the living dead." For decades, researchers have documented much higher levels of mental illness and substance abuse among the homeless than in the rest of the population. It's true that just 8 and 18% of homeless people point to mental illness and substance abuse, respectively, as the primary cause of their homelessness. But researchers have long understood that such self-reports are unreliable due to the socially undesirable nature of substance abuse and the lack of insight that often accompanies mental illness. Using other methods, San Francisco's health department in 2019 estimated that 4,000 of the city's 8,035 homeless, sheltered and unsheltered, are both mentally ill and suffering from substance abuse. Of those 4,000, about 1,600 frequently used emergency psychiatric services. The same is true in other cities. In 2019, the Los Angeles Times analyzed government data and found that 2/3 of homeless in Los Angeles struggle with either addiction or mental illness. Against the insistence among some progressives that homelessness is strictly the result of poverty and housing prices, researchers for decades have documented not just the prevalence of mental illness and substance abuse among the homeless, but also their role in creating homelessness in the first place. A large 5,406-person study of U.S. veterans, published in 2021, found that the major personal characteristics of the unsheltered homeless were unmarried status, criminal justice problems, weak social support, medical diagnoses, drug but not alcohol problems, low income, and inability to afford basic needs. Wrote the authors, "Where weather was warmer or rents were higher, the number of personal risk factors mattered more. Homelessness," noted the authors, "reflects the interaction of person and place." Some things have gotten better. After negative publicity, the San Francisco city government signed a $1 million per year contract to clean up the needles and install more public toilets. As a result, Complaints to the city's 311 line about needles on the sidewalks declined nearly 34% from 2018 to 2020. But other things got worse. More people called the city demanding action to clear away bulky items in 2020 than in 2019. In 2020, the city received 29,162 requests to remove human or animal waste, and 6,275 needle complaints. As for the new toilets, they did not eliminate public urination and defecation. The city has installed 5 portable bathrooms for the hundreds of unsheltered people in the Tenderloin, noted the New York Times in 2018. But that has not stopped people from urinating and defecating in the streets. In the past, governments and nonprofits had sometimes required homeless people to earn an apartment unit through sobriety, work, and, when appropriate, compliance with taking their psychiatric medicine. This is called the contingency approach, linear approach, or staircase approach, since one must earn the next step through good behavior. When we first started, said Margot Cashel, people believed that to provide housing, people needed to go through steps. First, a shelter. Then, if they behaved well, didn't use drugs, took medicines, etc., they could get to transitional housing. If they did everything right, then they could be offered permanent housing. As a result, only a tiny proportion of people with behavioral disabilities became housed. Housing First turned that upside down, she explained. Recognizing that when people were homeless, they couldn't attend to their mental health or substance use needs, or anything else. This has been enormously successful, housing about 85% of the most complex folks. There is overwhelming and incontrovertible evidence that this works. People are housed successfully, and then the other things follow. Utah garnered widespread media attention after state officials claimed a 91% decline in chronic homelessness because of its adoption of Housing First. The Los Angeles Times declared, "Utah is winning the war on chronic homelessness with Housing First." Said NBC, "Utah is battling homelessness by giving the needy shelter first and then aiding them with job placement. And it's working." Housing First provides housing without conditions. There is no empirical support for the practice of requiring individuals to participate in psychiatric treatment or attain sobriety before being housed, wrote founder of Housing First, Sam Semberis. Cashel agreed. You hear people saying things like, you can't just house people who have addiction problems. You can, and you must. The George W. Bush administration made Housing First federal policy. It helped cities and states create plans to end chronic homelessness in 10 years through permanent supportive housing, and provided money after they had done so. By 2009, more than 200 cities and states had done so. At a local TV news station's roundtable discussion in 2017, elected officials and top homelessness advocates from each of the Bay Area's counties were adamant that Housing First was the only solution to homelessness. Housing is the solution to homelessness, said San Francisco's top homelessness official. Housing First is the solution to ending homelessness, said Berkeley's mayor. And, stressed San Jose's mayor, we ultimately all agree that the only real solution is permanent supportive housing. From 2005 to 2020, San Francisco experienced an astonishing 95% increase in unsheltered homelessness as the number of permanent supportive housing units offered by the city rose from 6,487 to 10,051. Today, San Francisco has the greatest quantity of permanent supportive housing units per capita of any major city in the United States. It has 11 permanent supportive housing units per 1,000 people, which is nearly 3 times as much as New York, 4 per 1,000 people, and Chicago, 4 per 1,000. and nearly four times as much as Los Angeles County, 3 per 1,000. All of that, and yet the unsheltered homeless population of New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles fell 11, 10, and 37% respectively between 2005 and 2019, while San Francisco's rose 95%. Why was that? The mind behind Proposition C was Jennifer Friedenbach, executive director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, a Silicon Valley native who rebelled against her parents' middle-class, conservative lifestyle. Friedenbach has taken a small salary and dedicated her life to working on homelessness since the 1990s. Friedenbach and other advocates for the homeless attribute the rise of homelessness to President Ronald Reagan. "The reason we have mass homelessness," she said, "is the federal government's fault. They divested or disinvested from funding housing in the early 80s by 78%. A permanent supportive housing provider in the Tenderloin told me, "It's absolutely undisputed that the homeless crisis in America began after severe cuts to federal affordable housing funds." And an ACLU expert said, "The Reagan administration slashed the budget for our federal affordable housing programs by 80%. But public spending on housing barely changed under Reagan, going from $41.8 billion to $40.6 billion between 1981 and 1989, in constant 2019 dollars. Reagan did oversee the end of public housing construction, but this was in the context of a shift away from federal housing projects toward rental subsidies, which began under Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, and for good reason. In the late 1960s, there was growing unhappiness with public housing, particularly high-rise apartment complexes for the urban poor. They had been built with the greatest of progressive and liberal intentions, to provide former residents of poor neighbors with modern apartment units. But they became infamous for concentrating poverty, crime, and violence. In the wake of that and other well-publicized failures, Congress sought better solutions, ultimately embracing rental vouchers or Section 8 certificates. Under Section 8 of the Housing and Community Development Act of 1974, Congress created vouchers to pay the difference between a tenant's rent and 25% of his or her monthly income for 15 years. The reforms proved more efficient. It cost half as much to house someone with a Section 8 certificate as it did to subsidize construction. And low-income families greatly preferred the freedom to choose their own housing rather than be assigned to a public housing project. Crack was a major factor behind the emergence of homelessness as a problem in the 1980s. Buna Chima, a former homeless service provider and advocate in Berkeley, estimated in the early 1990s that 85% of the homeless in her Oakland shelter had recently used crack, and that there are almost no family ties left among them. Crack radically reduced the price of cocaine, along with the duration of the high, making it available to the poor and working class. The cost of crack declined from $10 to $3 for a single hit between the mid-1980s and early 1990s. The conventional wisdom holds that the increase in homelessness in the 1980s resulted in part from the loss of low-cost, often substandard housing. But it was San Francisco's preservation of such housing and conversion into housing for the homeless, which helped make the homeless addiction problem so much worse than in other cities. Most of San Francisco's low-cost housing came in the form of single-resident occupancy hotels, where residents had a single room and usually shared a kitchen and bathroom. The number of single-resident occupancy units per capita declined by two-thirds in New York and Chicago from the mid-1970s to today. San Francisco, which started with nearly twice as many units per capita, lost only one-third during the same period. Advocacy for the preservation of single-resident occupancy hotels occurred within the broader progressive movement. Democrats until the late 1960s were pro-development and had led efforts to demolish slums, build public housing, and revitalize the inner city. But starting in the late 1960s, baby boomers and the New Left turned against redevelopment. They were inspired by an influential 1961 book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs, which blamed redevelopment, like that which had occurred in the Fillmore neighborhood of San Francisco, for destroying neighborhoods with freeways and high-rises, evicting low-income residents and making them unlivable, as compared to highly walkable neighborhoods like Greenwich Village. But redevelopment occurred in Greenwich Village, whereas the city of San Francisco increasingly subsidized housing for the homeless in the Tenderloin single-resident occupancy hotels, which have for decades been dominated by a culture of heavy substance use and prostitution. Of the people in supportive housing in San Francisco, 93% have a major mental illness that we can name, said a housing policymaker. That is very, very high. 80% use cocaine, speed, or heroin every 30 days, or get drunk to the point of unconsciousness. Tom Wolfe, a former Salvation Army caseworker and a member of San Francisco's Drug Dealing Task Force, says the city's supportive housing facilities are themselves a major market for illegal drugs. Go down the street to the Camelot Hotel on Church Street, said Wolfe. Almost everyone that I've seen in those hotels are using. The last front desk guy that was working there got busted because he was selling crack. The actual guy that works in the single resident occupancy hotel is selling crack. It's insane, man. According to many homelessness researchers, the defining characteristics of chronic homelessness are addiction and disaffiliation, or estrangement from friends and family. What causes homelessness among these skid row dwellers? Asked a leading researcher in the early 1990s. Addiction and the lack of a support system, said Tracy Helton Mitchell, who wrote a memoir about her heroin addiction in the Tenderloin. When I left my hometown, I cut myself off from my support system, both emotionally and financially. In November 1991, San Francisco voters elected a former police chief mayor on a promise to move the homeless off the streets and crack down on nuisance crimes, like littering, camping in parks, and aggressive panhandling. He also offered housing and services, subsidized 2,000 moderate and low-income housing units, and sent outreach workers to offer shelter and drug treatment. And the new mayor fought against the expansion of funding for single-resident occupancy hotel rooms, which he viewed as a magnet for hard drug users, triggering protests organized by the nonprofit housing and service provider organizations. 4 years later, Willie Brown, a powerful former state legislator from San Francisco and the highest-ranking African-American in the state, was elected mayor. Brown seized on the perception among progressive Democrats in San Francisco that the city's approach to homelessness was cruel. In my administration, Brown promised, police will spend their time going after crack dealers, thugs, aggressive panhandlers, and other predators, rather than rounding up people whose only crime is being poor. But Brown never stopped the sweeps of the homeless, and increasingly sounded like his predecessor. If you put together really aggressive and attractive programs, he said in 1996, you begin to establish an identity where advocates may become a source of supply for your population. The San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness and other progressives felt betrayed. I don't have the answer, Brown said. I'm not working toward anything at this moment except the maintenance of current programs, but that's not a solution. Brown called off a homelessness summit, saying, I couldn't get the advocates to believe that we were sincere about trying to find solutions. In 2001, San Francisco supervisor Gavin Newsom proposed a new ballot measure, Care Not Cash. Its main feature was the diversion of general assistance, welfare, cash payments into housing. But its broader goal was to shift funding from shelters to permanent supportive housing. Newsom was motivated in part by evidence that people were coming to San Francisco for its generous cash welfare payments. San Francisco at the time gave homeless individuals between $320 and $395 per month, while Oakland gave just $24. Newsom proposed cutting the San Francisco payments to $57 per month and diverting the money saved to housing, mostly single-resident occupancy units. Homeless activists savaged the measure. "The Newsom plan is heartless, ruthless, and basically immoral," said a Roman Catholic nun who provided homelessness services. But Care Not Cash passed with 60% of the vote. While Care Not Cash modestly reduced general assistance costs, just 15% of the single homeless population was able to secure basic housing. And so, after his election as mayor in 2003, Newsom put together a task force including labor unions, businesses, and the Coalition on Homelessness to create a 10-year plan. "The focus," said the task force leader, "is permanent supportive housing for the 3,000 or so chronically homeless, out of the 15,000 general homeless populations." Spirits were high. Under the new plan, task force leaders claimed the city would spend just $16,000 per year per chronically homeless person on housing and care, which was dramatically less than the $61,000 city officials estimated that San Francisco was already spending in the form of emergency services, incarceration, and other means. "I think a 10-year plan is absolutely workable and absolutely doable," said the task force leader. "And don't let anyone tell you that it's not." While some may have doubted that San Francisco would completely solve the problem of chronic homelessness within 10 years, few could have predicted just how much worse it would get.